Brewster, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom.
Feel a little froggy this morning, Judge. I've been battling this horrible cold that's going around, so I apologize for that.
You may proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Brewster of Anderson, Klein, Brewster, and Brandt of Kearney and Holdridge. I am here today representing the appellant, Angelo Boll. Angelo Boll, on December 15, 2014, went to the Gibbon Packing Plant in Gibbon, Nebraska. That's in Buffalo County. And he shot and killed a man by the name of Carell Perez Almaguer. Immediately after this happened, a law enforcement officer, Deputy Brad Hall of the Buffalo County Sheriff's Office, within literally seconds, was there on the scene and arrested Mr. Bull where the shooting occurred. He was subsequently charged with first-degree murder and use of a weapon to commit a felony. On May 8th of 2015, he entered the District Court of Buffalo County at what we call a progression hearing, and he entered a plea of no contest to first-degree murder, with the weapons charge being dismissed through a plea bargain. Subsequently, he was sentenced to life imprisonment, and this appeal follows. The problem with all of this, Your Honor, is that the progression hearing, the arraignment, rearrangement, if you will, went on with Mr. Bull really not having any idea about what was happening during the arraignment progression hearing process.
Now what's your evidence of that in the record?
If you read the record, Judge, if you look at the exchange...
I read that, and I saw instances where the defendant expressed that he didn't understand a question.
Yes.
And always those bumps were resolved. It didn't look to me to be anything out of the ordinary in a plea hearing, and I was hoping you could explain to me your position.
The position, Your Honor, is that, well, first of all, let's go to this point. Mr. Bull is from the Sudan, which is a third world country. And
sure. Was there, what's the evidence in the record that it was a language barrier that prompted the question or the confusion over some of the legal issues during the plea colloquy?
I think the basics of the responses that he gave to the court when he was asked certain questions.
Did he ever say, I'm sorry, I don't understand what that word means in English, or I'm having difficulty understanding you, this isn't my first language? Was there anything like that?
There's a couple of points in there where the judge did ask him a question and said, do you understand this? And he said, no. There was another point in there.
Isn't that just what's supposed to happen when the judge says in a plea colloquy, do you understand that? If the defendant who's entering their plea doesn't understand, don't you want them to say they don't so that the judge can clear it up?
Yes.
And didn't that happen here?
I don't think so.
You have an instance where Mr. Bull said, I don't understand, and the judge proceeded without a further attempt at explanation?
I'm sorry, what kind of explanation, Judge?
The defendant was asked, do you understand, and do you have an instance where the defendant said, no, I don't understand, and that was it, without further explanation or without a further attempt by the judge?
The court tried to explain it, but again, throughout the course of the record, it appears abundantly clear to me that he wasn't getting it.
An answer to a different question, because the judge, in my reading of the bill, frequently would say, do you understand? And as I recall, the defendant would say yes or no, and the judge would rephrase it and then get a yes and then move on. Do you have an instance in this record where the defendant would say, do you understand? And the defendant says, no, or I don't get it, or words to that effect, and the judge just blows it off and keeps going down with the colloquy without further effort?
No, I do not have that. You're absolutely right.
How long had the appellant been in the United States?
Since 2001, I believe.
I think the record shows that he applied for and obtained a commercial driver's license.
It does.
That's no small accomplishment. I haven't looked at the exam, but it would seem to me that even to drive a passenger car, that takes some, to pass that test takes some understanding of the English language.
Well, I think it was in Pennsylvania. I don't know what their requirements might be to get a CDL there.
But I also notice in the record that when he's explaining the crime, and it went on, well, it was transcribed for 6.5 pages, and it appeared that Mr. Bowl was pretty fluent, and the conversation was fluent in English at that time.
Are you talking about the sentencing hearing?
Yes.
See, my reading of that, it was just a bunch of gibberish, rattling on about his paranoid thoughts concerning his co-employees and some supervisor that was there. Let me suggest this to you, if I might. This isn't in the record.
Do you think the record is sufficient to get at the claim that you're really trying to make, is that he didn't get it because of the language barrier?
You know, maybe it's because I've visited with him personally, and you can't see that. It seems abundantly clear to me. The worst part of what's in the record has to do with the explanation of the sentence. I think if there's anything there, that is the one thing that is really a problem with this particular rearrangement. The first thing that happens is the judge asks the county attorney to tell the defendant, the appellant, what is the sentence, and he says it's life imprisonment. Well, he doesn't say that the maximum is life imprisonment and the minimum is life imprisonment, which I believe is what is supposed to happen. And the fact that the county attorney is telling him this and not the court makes that part of the process, I think, suspect. Now, there's no law that says anything about it, but that has always bothered me.
He understood he was getting life because he says, how am I going to get out earlier if it's life? And then the court painstakingly, said that sometimes it served less than life.
That's not right. It's when you're sentenced to life imprisonment for first-degree murder, that's it. As I understand it, there's no parole for that.
What was the deal for pleading no contest?
They dismissed a weapons charge.
They wasn't threatened with the death penalty or anything like that?
That never came
up.
There.
Never an issue?
No.
He was from the Sudan?
That's right.
He knows what murder is?
I suspect that he very likely does.
And he knows there's penalties that can be enforced for you with regard to killing another human being?
Your Honor, I think that in the Sudan, that's how they settle their differences. And I'm not sure they have any courts to enforce much
so
when
what
differences
part of
are
the,
settled.
What part of the plea didn't he understand?
I don't think he understood the sentencing aspect. It was pretty clear to me he didn't understand the pleas.
He got that explained to him, didn't he?
He did. But without an interpreter there to make absolutely sure that he did understand what was happening.
Whose obligation is that?
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure. I think it's the court's obligation, but I also think it's the defendant's counsel's obligation if he or she doesn't think that the defendant gets it.
Are there interpreters for the language that he spoke?
Apparently there was one that they tried to get when they were going to interview him after the offense occurred, and somewhat mysterious to me, but that interpreter, I guess, decided he didn't want to participate. I can guess why, but, you know, it's not in the record, and I don't want to speculate about it. But are there interpreters? I would imagine so.
What does the evidence in this record show about the interview at the booking and his language skills?
He was interviewed by Investigator Paul Kern with the Buffalo County Sheriff's Office, who I will tell you is one of the finest law enforcement officers I've ever known. And I know Paul well. And he's a good cop, and he knows what he's doing. The evidence was that they had this interview. Apparently, Mr. Bull was cooperative, respectful. Investigator Kerner was asked if he felt that Mr. Bull understood what they were talking about. He indicated at a suppression hearing, I believe it was, that he did think that he did understand it. But the problem there, Your Honor, is that is at an interview by a law enforcement officer with a suspect in a major crime. That's a totally different arena than what we're talking about appearing in the district court of Buffalo County and entering a plea to first-degree murder.
Justice Castle asked you a question about whether or not the record we have in front of us adequately conveyed the problem that you claim your client had. What is missing from that record?
To demonstrate the problem?
Yes.
You know, I think one of the most telling statements in the record, Judge, is when Judge Wright speaks this very short phrase to him, I believe it was, "You seem to be having some trouble understanding me." And in my mind, right there, that should have been the point where the court or Mr. Bull's counsel should have stood up and said, you know, this isn't right, this isn't working, we need an interpreter to get in here and make sure that this is being done correctly.
Well, even with defendants who are born and raised in the United States, it's not unusual in a plea colloquy to have a lack of understanding. Language isn't the only problem that can arise in understanding a plea colloquy. How does this record demonstrate that it's language and not something else?
First of all, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that happens so often to us with clients that aren't very well educated. You know, you got a 10th grade education and they didn't do that well, and they come in and what you have to do with that person is you have to work with them before the hearing to make sure that they do understand. We don't have any indication that that happened. There was a point where I believe Mr. Marsh, who represented Mr. Bull, you know, did stop the proceeding at some point because Mr. Bull didn't understand the immigration consequences. So he did do that.
Is your ineffective counsel claim, does that encompass this?
It does.
I don't want to frame it for you, but something to the effect that the advice of counsel may have been deficient in the sense of getting the client ready to proceed at a plea hearing.
That's correct.
What is your client?
How would we know on this record?
Well, just by virtue of the fact that, and again, this is my interpretation of it, it doesn't appear that he understood what was happening during the course of the proceedings, even though he did respond yes or no.
But they didn't always respond yes or no, and quite frankly, his responses were correct. And when he didn't understand something, he said, "What does this mean?" And then the court would explain to him. Doesn't that indicate to a certain degree that he understood what was going on when the court says something and he doesn't just say yes, no, he says, "What does this mean?"
I think that presumes that he understood the explanation, and I don't know if we can make that assumption.
what does your client ultimately want here? Does he want to withdraw his plea? Does he want to go to trial? What?
I don't know, honestly. All I got was I didn't understand what was happening here. I didn't. The sentence thing is what I think is the big deal. He didn't understand the sentencing aspect.
He doesn't like the plea because of the sentence that's required.
Well, he doesn't now.
What was the factual basis for the state's conviction?
Oh, pretty simple. Mr. Bowl had been an employee at the Gibbon Pack, and he was extremely unhappy with this gentleman, Mr. Perez Almaguer, because he'd been teasing him. So he decided that he was going to take care of him. And he went to his home in Grand Island. He got a pistol that he owned, apparently owned for quite a while. He went right straight back to Gibbon Packing Plant. He waited for this man to come out. And right there in the parking lot, he gunned him down.
Any witnesses?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was all kinds of people out there. It was horrible. I mean, horrible experience for these people.
How many times was he shot?
7 or 9. He unloaded the clip. I think. I can't remember specifically. It was several times. So, the appeal base, Your Honor, the reason I'm here is, you know, based on, you know, what I've been asked to do, and I don't think what happened in court is right. I think he needed an interpreter. I think that's the standard that we should have, especially in a case like this. You know, we're not talking about a driving under suspension thing. You know, this is a first-degree murder, and...
Well, language understanding is a continuum. It's not a black and white. You have people that one end of the continuum who clearly understand. The language isn't the issue. They may not understand because of educational deficiencies or mental deficiencies or whatever, but language isn't the problem. You have people at the other end of the continuum who literally can't speak a word, and they absolutely have to have an interpreter. Those are clear. But you have all different sorts of shades in between. What are you asking us to do with respect to the shades? It seems to me what you're saying is if the judge sort of picks up a signal, maybe, kind of, that somehow is mandatory. And that, I think, may be a little bit of a stretch in the realistic situation of the trial courts.
Your Honor, what I'm asking you to do, in the interest of due process, is to err on the side of caution.
You think this was not good enough?
Not good enough. I used to work for the city of Holdridge when I was in undergraduate school, and there was this fellow I worked with, and we'd do a job, and it wasn't really very good, and he'd always say, well, close enough for government work. And I thought, well, that's not right. And, you know, this isn't close enough. It needs to be done right. And I guess that's what I'm asking you to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Love, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is George Love on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. As I pointed out in brief, I didn't see that there were 7 assignments of error which were not specifically argued in brief. And so I broke it out, and I think basically assignments of error 1, 3, 4, and 6 deal with the Boykin Irish Rights Advisement. I believe assignment of error number 2 deals with the advisement on the penalty. Number 5 is the ineffective assistance of counsel for not bringing up the or requesting an interpreter. And then finally, number seven is trial court error for not appointing an attorney. So I think...
An interpreter?
I'm sorry, not an interpreter. Thank you. So I think the majority of these turn on number seven and the Irish Boynton rights. District court erring and not appointing an interpreter. I think
the
law...
I beg your pardon, because we're in talking to Mr. Brewster, I think that's the point he wants to unwind this to.
That's correct,
A new plea hearing with an interpreter.
Well, I assume that would be the remedy, is that, to vacate the conviction and then remand for further proceedings, and then it would be up to Mr. Bowl to decide whether he wanted to replead with an interpreter or go forward to trial.
Okay.
Would be, but I don't think that's necessary here.
Thank you.
Not on this record. The point being is that, as this court has noted in an exchange with counsel, language, there really isn't a language barrier here, and I think the case that I cited in brief with respect to the Topi case, I guess that's how you pronounce it, where the record satisfactorily demonstrates that such defendant had sufficient command of the English language to understand the question posed, in the end, there is no abuse of discretion in refusing to appoint an interpreter. And there's no question that this record reflects that Mr. Bowl, on various questions regarding, for example, the distinction between a guilty plea and a no contest plea, said, no, I don't understand. So the court would back up, re-explain it, or put it in different terms, and then he would say, okay, I do understand that now. So, and I think the distinction is this. If I went to an astrophysics conference, I would have very great difficulty in understanding what the conference was about. I would catch certain parts of it because I assume it's in English, but it wouldn't mean I would understand every term, and that's the same thing that we have here. Law is a unique field, okay, and it has its own language, and the words have its own meaning. That's why the language barrier is not here, okay? And the factors that this court might want to look at is Mr. Bowl has been in the country since 2001. He spoke with the investigator for over 2 hours. He knowingly, voluntarily waived his Miranda rights. The court at the suppression hearing went through the testimony, made various findings of fact on the motion to suppress, and basically said there's no basis to suppress the evidence here because he understands English. So he spoke with the investigator 2 hours prior to. He declined during that interview to have an interpreter. There was no indication in that 2 hours that he didn't understand what the investigator was telling him. So that's another factor. He declined an interpreter during the investigation. He spoke with the officer while being booked in and had no problem in understanding the questions being posed to him. Again, he didn't request an interpreter. He had no difficulty during the pre-sentence interview in understanding the English language and understood the process in that proceeding. And last but not least, the Bill of Exception reflects 6 pages of Mr. Bowl's allocution during the sentencing hearing. The language isn't what we would call perfect in grammar, but it's clearly understandable, and it's clear from that he understood what was going on, and he could allocute very well in English. So I think if you look at all of those factors, add all of that up, and then come to the conclusion, I think it just invariably come to the conclusion that Mr. Bowl's plea was freely, knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered. There were hiccups. We're not denying that. But the question is, did he understand what was going on? And I think the answer to that is just clear from the record. He did. And the court made sure he did. So I don't think
our standard of review of the court's determination?
Abuse of discretion, Your Honor. So I don't think that the record in any way supports it. getting over an abuse of discretion standard with respect to the court erring in not appointing an interpreter. If the court reaches that conclusion, then the ineffective assistance of counsel claim disappears because there could be no prejudice because there was no error in not appointing an attorney. As far as the minimum maximum sentence...
Appointing an interpreter.
I'm sorry. What did I say, attorney again?
Yes.
Gosh, I'm sorry. I guess I'm just used to... post-conviction, yes, exactly. I'm sorry. So I think the ineffective assistance of counsel claim for not requesting an interpreter would fall because there could be no prejudice shown given there was no abuse of discretion. And if the court looks, I believe I lined out in brief the Boykin Irish rights and the advisement under Hayes was proper. And I think there's a checklist that also, in addition to the Bill of Exceptions, shows this court of all of his rights, and that's in T23.
Mr. Buck, you're taking a clear position that the record is clearly sufficient to refute the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. That's your position.
Yes.
As I sit here, there's a part of me that's nagging about whether that record is sufficient based on these little sorts of what you called hiccups. I'm not prepared to say the record requires a reversal on direct appeal, but I sort of am wondering if it might be wiser to leave open the door for post-conviction.
Your Honor, my personal view of that is it's always a good idea to do that. I think it's better to have an evidentiary hearing and have counsel testify and the defendant testify if the court finds that the allegation under State v. Philholm is sufficient to state a cause, then I think it's always wise to hear from counsel as to why not.
I think what we're hearing formatted differently is that maybe that the defendant has language skill, but when you go to the element of knowingly and intelligently, maybe he doesn't have a full understanding of the proceeding.
Aren't we reviewing that in this case?
I couldn't hear you, Your Honor.
Aren't we reviewing that in this case?
Well, yes, and I respectfully disagree.
And
because
I'm trying to separate out language ability from the element, the Irish on the Irish
Boykin
list
of Irish, right,
understand intelligently, right, understanding. So he's maybe hearing the words and having a exchange and adequate verbal quantity knowingly and understand the proceeding.
I think the record supports he did, and the fact that he did say, no, I don't understand, and the court went back and explained it, and then he said, okay, now I understand basically what's going on. I think that absolutely supports a knowing, voluntary, intelligent
understand
waiver.
The words or understand the legal consequence, I guess I'm trying to make a distinction.
I think he did, and I think you can look at the assignment of error with regard to the penalty. Under the Fisher standard, it doesn't matter how he learned it. In other words, it's not the court that has to tell him your sentence range is X to Y. The statute on first-degree murder is clear. It just says your penalty is life. It doesn't say...
Do you think the advisement with respect to the penalty is accurate?
Yes. Yes, but I would say this to the court. I don't think it's a good idea for a district court to advise of the to have the county attorney advise of the penalty. I think that's a court function. I don't think it's wrong, but it's not best practice, is what I would say.
Did this advisement plant the seed of something other than life to life?
I don't think so, because the county attorney basically said the penalty is life.
Okay.
So, and that's what the statute says, so... I don't think there's a complaint that he...
I mean, is there anything in here that invited a misunderstanding of the penalty?
Well, only in the sense that some think that there has to be a minimum and a maximum sentence stated, because the remainder of the statutes, usually in criminal statutes, have a minimum maximum term. First-degree murder doesn't. It's just life.
Mr. Love, what do you make of the court's response when Mr. Bull asked, how can I leave if I will be sentenced to life? And the court says, that's correct,
However, life sentences are not always necessarily life sentences. There are occasions when persons who are sentenced to life in prison get released, perhaps long after, blah, 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 that exchange.
Thank
you. What do you make of that?
I think the court was trying to give Mr. Wall a hint that he may be able to go to the Board of Pardons and get his life sentence reduced to a determinate sentence. I think that was the point of that.
Well, it perhaps lies behind that, but how in the world does it convey that information?
It does not, okay. Point blank. It does not. But the fact of the matter is, his question of whether or not, how do I get out, you don't. It's life.
So from your perspective, the question plus the first part of that answer, that's correct.
That's right.
Sort of sealed the understanding.
That's
and the
right.
Rest of that warbling didn't have a significant.
But my concern was what this color added to otherwise fragile understanding of what was going on.
I didn't hear the first part of the question.
The life-to-life part would be accurate, but then this, however, you know, there's times something gives, might have muddied a fragile
exactly
understanding of the proceedings.
I agree that probably muddied the proceedings, but the question is, what was he, or the assigned error is was he advised of the penalty? And the answer is yes. He stated he understood it.
Thank you.
So there's not much more I don't think a district court can do than ask if you do understand. In other words, you're pretty serious business here.
Well, he could ask the question in a form that would require a verbal response other than yes or no. He could ask the defendant to explain what he understood.
That's true. You could do that,
too. That might give a better indication, but that wasn't necessarily done in this case.
That's very true. That's very true. You could do that as well. But I think the Hayes and the Boynkin Irish and all of that basically is the court is to be constitutionally sound is to pose the question to the defendant and get a response as to whether or not he understands what he's doing. He says yes. Well, when the jailhouse door slams shut, then your time for complaining is pretty much over. So. Anyway, I would point out, Your Honors, I don't believe the record and the factors that I've just previously outlined to the court with respect to the appointment of an interpreter in this case reflect an abuse of discretion. If the court finds that number 7, there was no error in number 7, then not number 5 falls apart in terms of that, because I believe this is addressable on appeal, if I may, Justice Castle, and the reason is because under no circumstances, if 7 was not an abuse of discretion, could you find prejudice on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for not asking for an interpreter? You could never show prejudice there. So I think it is addressable on direct appeal. Most, 99.99% of the time, I would agree with you, Your Honor, that it's better to leave it for an evidentiary hearing. But if 7 is correct, then 5 falls apart. It has to. And then with respect to the Irish advisements, that's assignments 1, 3, 4, and 6. I think the record overwhelmingly reflects that the court ensured that Mr. Bowell understood his constitutional rights and that he knowingly, freely, and voluntarily waived his constitutional rights when he pled. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the district court in all respects.
Thank you. Is there time for rebuttal? A minute and 44 seconds, Mr. Brewster. Thank you very much for your appointed in this matter. Thank you very much for your service. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is State v. Michael E. Harris.